today on Against the Grain. It's called the Imperial Boomerang, and the effect it's had on policing in the U.S. is momentous. I'm C.S. The sociologist Julian Goh discusses his new book about empire, race, and the militarization of the police, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Police forces today have a vast array of tools, techniques, and technologies at their disposal. Why is that? What accounts for the militarization of the police? And when did this phenomenon begin? In his new book, Policing Empires, Julian Goh links police militarization with colonial and imperial conquest and with racialization, the racialization of imperial subjects and colonized peoples, and of certain populations in the U.S. targeted by police activity and repression. Julian Goh is professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. Much of his work focuses on U.S. imperialism and postcolonial thought. Julian Goh's new book is Policing Empires: Militarization, Race, and the Imperial Boomerang in Britain and the U.S. When Julian and I connected recently, I asked him about the book's overarching project.
So what really drove me to research and write this book was really this incredible puzzle of the police that I think a lot of us had been seeing. Of course, we saw a lot of policing of Black Lives Matter in 2020, but of course we can go back further to 2014 and the Ferguson so-called riots, and what intrigued me about this is the way in which the police seemed to be an army, right? They seemed to be equipped like an army. They seemed to be trained like an army, and a lot of other observers noticed this too. We call it the militarization of the police, right? And so I was really fascinated with this militarization of the police because it's a strange thing in a number of respects. I mean, for one thing, we have a police who are armed and trained to treat citizens like enemies of war, right? Treat citizens like enemy combatants rather than as civilians and citizens. And those very citizens are paying for that, for those military arms and training that the police have. And so this is really puzzling. And I began to wonder how and why we got here. And so I began some initial thinking about this and some initial research. And one of the striking things I found out is when you look at the history of policing in the U.S. and Britain, you'll see that, in fact, there's in many ways an ideal of the so-called civil police that the U.S. is supposed to have, and it's modeled after the British policing model. And it's not supposed to be a police that is at all militarized. The civil police is an ideal of policing that was sort of the founding ideal of policing when police departments were formed in the 19th century. And they were not supposed to be armed, militarized forces treating citizens like enemy combatants. They were supposed to be police of, by, and for civilians. And so this was an ideology, a unique British-American model that was born in the 19th century in London, and then the U.S. police departments, when they were formed, they copied this model. And so what's puzzling historically is that somehow we seem to have gotten from this ideal of a civil police, which people still pronounce, we've gotten from this ideal of a civil police to a heavily armed, militarized police that looks no different than the army. And I just was wondering how in the hell did we get here? And as a historical sociologist, that's really the kind of question that drives me. How and why did we get to the place where we are now?
Most scholars, you note, maintain that a wave of police militarization, a new wave of police militarization, began after August 1965. What happened then and around then in Los Angeles and elsewhere in the U.S.?
Yeah, so this is one of the stories we tell about how and why the police became militarized. We look to a number of different things. Some people look to some programs that the federal government enacted in the 1980s and 90s when they passed laws such as the National Defense Authorization Act of 1990, which allowed local police departments to get excess military equipment, and some people trace militarization to that period. Others go back to exactly 1964 and what happened there. And what happened there was the beginnings of the so-called Watts riots. Now, for those of you who might have short memories of history, I certainly wasn't alive at that point, but anybody who's, you know, who was alive at that point would probably remember the Watts uprising, which exploded in 1965, really. And this was essentially a black uprising in the poor, impoverished communities of African Americans in LA, starting in Watts. And the response to Watts was the creation, well, one of the many responses was the creation of a unit that we now think of as a SWAT team, right? Special weapons and tactics units within the police. And this is a heavily armed, militarized unit. And it was formed by two LAPD officers, John Nelson and Daryl Gates, who, after facing the Watts riots, felt that police were not equipped with dealing with such uprisings, and decided to then form this new unit within the LAPD, which is now well known. It was originally called the Special Weapons and Attack Team, but it was later renamed Special Weapons and Tactics. And this was a heavily militarized, small elite group within the LAPD, trained in military tactics and using military-grade weaponry. And this became the model for a lot of other departments around the U.S. The federal government funded this under the Johnson administration, and funded all kinds of other programs by which the local police could become more militarized. And so many historians look to this period as the beginnings of this militarization. One of the things I found is that there's a deeper story there that we can talk about. But, you know, this is why the 1960s are seen by many people as an important starting point for militarization, is because of the response to the Watts riots was heavy militarization, and SWAT units represent that. And of course, what we know is after the LAPD formed its SWAT units, it spread all around the country. Cities created their own SWAT type units after this.
Talk a little bit more about what the SWAT unit was designed to do. And also, John Nelson was one of the co-creators of the SWAT unit in the LAPD. And what should we know about what Nelson did before joining the Los Angeles Police Department?
So one of the interesting things about the formation of this SWAT unit was that it really comes from not just the military, but from long-standing series of military operations and military type units. And John Nelson represented this. He had been in the US military before creating SWAT. He had served in elite military units, sometimes known as force recon units, which at the time in Vietnam were helping squash the guerrillas, the Viet Cong in the jungle. And so actually the formation of SWAT was very much a modeling after these counterinsurgency or these military units, such as Nelson had previously served in. Early forms had been developed during World War II. And Nelson came to the LAPD with this background, with this military background, and in particular with knowledge of these force recon units. And in fact, this was part of a larger pattern of the formation of SWAT. Both Nelson and Gates really meant it as a elite militarized unit modeled after military counterinsurgency units that at the time, of course, were being deployed in Vietnam. And Nelson and Gates were really thinking of the Watts uprising as akin to a kind of guerrilla warfare. They explicitly called it, this is guerrilla warfare, right? They said this is hugely different from what we had encountered before and what we had been taught to encounter, Gates later recalled. And he decided, and he and Nelson decided, we need something new. And what the new thing was these military counterinsurgency units that they were copying.
Right, so we could look at the creation of LAPD's SWAT unit in the aftermath of the uprisings in Watts and elsewhere as that new wave, not the first wave, but a new wave of police militarization. And yet you write that SWAT did not represent much that was new. In this context, you bring up, among other things, the NYPD's, the New York Police Department's Tactical Patrol Force. When was that unit created? And what was it created to do?
Yeah, you're exactly right. A lot of people turn to SWAT and the period afterwards as a moment of militarization. The historian Elizabeth Hinton has a great book about this, and other scholars have written about this. And there's no doubt that SWAT and what came after represented this momentous wave of police militarization that is still with us today. But one of the things I found in researching this book is that SWAT was really the tip of the iceberg, and that it was really just one part of a larger pattern of what I call the imperial boomerang, the imperial boomerang effect, to take from the post-colonial thinker M.A. Cesar, who coined this term, the colonial boomerang effect. And so what I learned when I tried to figure out the origins of militarization, and when I started looking into SWAT, and when I started looking at the deeper history, I found an entire hidden history that we, as historians and scholars and historical sociologists and political scientists, that we know little about. And so, in fact, the way I think about militarization and what I found from my research is that militarization is really not the most precise term. And this is why I think we want to talk about it as the boomerang effect of empire. And this means that when countries like the United States go abroad, they engage in wars of colonial conquest or imperial conquest, when they're doing all this militaristic, coercive, violent activity in the imperial peripheries, these activities abroad that are part and parcel of imperialism abroad, they come home, right? They come home, in this case, in the form of what we call policing and what we call militarization. So SWAT, of course, is a good example of that, right? So these counterinsurgency units coming back from Vietnam. But before that, we had a whole series of SWAT-type units that were already formed in the United States and that were in turn modeled upon imperial counterinsurgency military units in the periphery. One of them was the New York Police Department's unit called the Tactical Patrol Force, and it was actually created in 1959. It was a specialized and heavily militarized squad led by military veteran and consisted of men from the NYPD who were all trained in judo and were riot control experts. They wore military-type gear, and they were essentially a pre-SWAT unit. But this is already in 1959. And these two had been modeled upon what the imperial militaries were doing overseas, and actually modeled upon also colonial units that had been formed in the colonial world as well. So SWAT, in this sense, was not new at all. It was really just the tip of this iceberg.
Julian Goh is my guest. He's professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. His new book is Policing Empires, Militarization, Race, and the Imperial Boomerang in Britain and the U.S. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So before we talk about the imperial military origins of some of these specific tools and technologies employed by units like SWAT and the NYPD's Tactical Patrol Force, how were the functions of tactical units in these police departments conceived to be different than the functions of regular police units?
These tactical units that SWAT represents, but certainly wasn't the first one, these we have to keep in mind were almost brand new for U.S. policing. They represented a new style of policing. And again, this is one of the most interesting things from my research into this book. So many things about the police that we take for granted today, you know, these are actual constructions. People made these. And a lot of them are more recent than we think. And, you know, today we kind of take SWAT units or, again, what really should be called tactical units, because that's what they were called at the time. We take them for granted. We expect police to have these types of units. But these were a relatively new form of policing. The dominant model of policing, expressed in what most police departments did, was really just, you know, you have the kind of policemen on the beat, right? They walked around their neighborhoods or they moved around in their cars and they patrolled these areas of the city called beats. The tactical units that SWAT represented and that the New York Police Department's Tactical Patrol Force represented was a new idea of policing. And this is an idea where rather than have regular beat patrols, whether on foot or in cars, you would actually have a group of elite forces within the department, specially trained, to sort of go in response to perceived outbreaks of crime. They would saturate an area, and this word saturation was used a lot. They would take over a part of the city that had seen to have had an outbreak of crime, and these were militarized police that really had no connection to the local neighborhood, right? This is different from the local police patrolman who you might know, right? You know, think about that movie West Side Story where you had Officer Krupke, who, you know, the kids in New York knew who he was and so on. And so there was, even with policing, there was a sense of the patrolman being known. But this tactical kind of approach that SWAT represented and that the New York Tactical Patrol Force represented was a kind of alien power, right? It was like these guys who really only would be sent to the neighborhood to patrol and, again, saturate, as it was called, and to almost like occupy the territory as an alien power. And part of it was a way to save on manpower, right? It was a way to, rather than have police all over the city, if you had relatively a fewer number of police than you wanted, then you would only send them out to hotspot areas, as they were called. These areas that, again, that were seen as these crime-ridden areas that need to be saturated with police. So this was a real new model of policing, and it you know, many critics eventually came to see that this was a the kind of policing that would then get criticized by the Black Panthers and other communities or representatives of largely Black communities and minority communities as a kind of occupying force. And so this is a new kind of policing at the time.
Who were typically assigned or maybe promoted to these units within police departments? Were they police officers of a certain kind?
They were to be handpicked from among the larger force, and the criteria were often basically the criteria that you might think of for a typical Marine or the type of criteria that you would think of for specialized military units. They had to be tall and strong, and they had to be trainable, and they had to have a kind of a militarized discipline. They had to be skilled in advanced weaponry. They really had to be as close to elite soldiers like the Green Berets, which was a kind of military tactical patrol force itself. And they were meant to be like these guys. And unsurprisingly, for SWAT, for example, in the LAPD, the vast majority were all veterans, military veterans from either the Korean War, or they had taken part in World War II, or even Vietnam. So this was an elite militarized unit, you know, the most militarized of the force, and they were selected precisely according to those kinds of criteria.
Now, when you looked into the sorts of weaponry and equipment that these tactical units were equipped with in the U.S., What did you find and discover about the origins, the places and venues in which such technologies and tools had been used before? Because they had been used before.
So these tactical patrol forces were new for U.S. policing, certainly. This is an important moment in policing history that has all kinds of implications. But they weren't new for the other arena from which they actually originated, which is the imperial world, the colonial world overseas. The very idea of a small, specialized, specially trained, militarized unit within the police comes from essentially the American and British colonies. One of the first police officers to come up with the idea of a specialized tactical patrol force was a man named August Vollmer, who was earlier in the 20th century the chief of the Berkeley Police, and who was known as the father of modern policing. He had originated all kinds of special police tactics and tools, but he himself got those from his experience in the colonial world. Particularly, he had served in the U.S. military during the America's conquest of the Philippines, beginning with the Philippine-American War, which lasted from 1899, more or less, through the first decade of military occupation in the Philippines and colonial occupation in the Philippines. And Vollmer comes back from that experience with all of these military ideas that he wanted to apply to policing. One of them, and there was a lot, but one of them is this idea of having a mobile strike force, as it was called, or a special mobile force of the very same kind that the military had been devising and using in the Philippines. For the Americans to conquer a place like the Philippines was also a very challenging thing. The Philippines is made up of thousands of islands and terrain, mountainous terrain, jungle terrain, that the Americans didn't really know. And the standard kind of military procedures and operations that you saw, say, during the Civil War, that wouldn't really work in a place like the Philippines. And so the military devised this idea of dividing up their forces into small mobile units that could move around swiftly and could be deployed swiftly into various areas, go into the jungle, track down insurgents and enemy combatants, and they would have not only specialized training, but they would also have knowledge about the terrain that they gained from mapping terrains, and they would basically be a recon force that later, of course, became common, such as in Vietnam, but which, again, at the time was relatively new. And these were improvised and devised and perfected in the Philippines during the Philippine-American War. And then they also spread to other parts of what I would think of as the American Empire. For example, the U.S. military in Haiti, when it occupied Haiti beginning in the 1910s, created similar small-scale military units and deployed them to phase down the CACO insurgency. One of those military leaders that created this kind of force was Smedley Butler, who was later police chief in Philadelphia. Mobile units were also used during the Marines' counterinsurgency efforts in Nicaragua during the 1920s. And so this was a development within the imperial periphery, and it's this form of tactical military counterinsurgency that was really copied then by people, police chiefs in the U.S. later to form something like the SWAT teams, but you know that it also was represented in the New York Tactical Patrol Force and in other units like in Chicago and San Francisco, you know, all around the U.S. So these are really colonial inventions devised to maintain colonial imperial conquest and rule.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Julian Go joins me. He teaches sociology at the University of Chicago. His books include American Empire and the Politics of Meaning, and post-colonial thought and social theory. We are discussing his new book. It's called Policing Empires, Militarization, Race, and the Imperial Boomerang in Britain and the U.S. It's published by Oxford University Press. We have a link to Julian Goh's faculty page at the University of Chicago, as well as to his new book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So we are focusing on a section of your book, Julian, about the 1950s and 1960s. And, you know, yeah, we could say, well, there was this SWAT unit created here, and there was a tactical police unit created there. They go by different names. But you then ask the question, the all-important question of why. Why the Imperial Boomerang? Why did it return in the late 1950s and 60s? Why the modalities of force used in places like the Philippines and Shanghai and Haiti and elsewhere were imported for domestic use at that time? Right, because the fact that, these sorts of imperial military tools and technologies were available doesn't mean that police departments would necessarily need to adopt them for use in their spaces, in their domestic, municipal spaces. You note that police officials across the U.S. acknowledged differences at the time between policing in rural, in quotes, and urban, in quotes, zones. And most agreed that the urban core of America, of the U.S., required much more complex policing systems, operations, and strategies than rural areas. What did people mean by rural and urban in the 1950s and going forward?
Yeah, this is a great question because it really cuts at the heart of something that I puzzle over in the book, which is really what I'm thinking of as the logic, the social logic of the boomerang effect. Now, I mentioned that the boomerang effect is this process whereby the United States or Britain goes overseas, innovates these tactics, coercive tactics, violent tactics, uses them to sustain empire, uses them on colonized populations overseas, and then those tactics and techniques and forms come home, right? And there's really two parts of the story here. One is certain innovators, imperial importers, like I mentioned August Vollmer at Berkeley, and then he went to LA. And you have these characters, military veterans, veterans of the colonial apparatus overseas, who experiment and develop these new techniques. But then the other story is why they spread. Like, why do other departments bother to use them such that they become eventually dominant, a dominant form of policing all around the country? And that's a real question that I was puzzling over. And in the particular period we're talking about, the late 1950s and early 1960s, the story emerges in discussions among police officials about how urban areas versus rural areas require these kinds of new techniques, and in this case, these tactical units. And these terms, urban and rural, again, we have to historicize them. We have a sense of what they mean now. What was happening after World War II in the United States was that this notion, this imaginary of the urban, was being increasingly racialized. This partly was conditioned by the demographic changes between 1950 and 1960, which is essentially a story of many white populations leaving cities and many racialized minority populations coming into cities. So, for example, Chicago's white population from 1950 to 1960 decreased by 13%, while its African-American population increased by 65%. Los Angeles, in the same period, had not only an African-American population already and a Latino population, but those latter racialized minority populations grew significantly in this period, right? In fact, in Los Angeles County, the African-American and Latino population rose from about 63,000 in 1940 to 763,000 in 1970. And by 1960, in fact, every major city in the United States, except for like Houston, had seen negative changes in the percentage of whites in their populations and positive changes in the percentage of non-whites. So all of this to say that these demographic processes set the condition for the urban to be imagined as a space increasingly colonized by non-white populations. And of course, given the tenor of racial consciousness at the time, or images of race at the time, what this really meant was that the urban represented these spaces of criminality, these spaces of black and brown populations basically posing a threat to whites living in the cities. And so what I show in the book and what I find from my research is that police officials really begin turning to these tactical units as a way to deal with this perceived rise in a racialized threat. And, you know, today we have this sort of fear of a crime waves emerging and rising crime. Well, this is exactly also what police officials at the time perceived, and it was racialized, right? This is the image of these non-white, these black and brown, you know, barbarians really coming and taking over cities, and the sense that we really need to put them under control, we need to manage them. And here's where the logic of the boomerang is so important. Because turning to these kind of coercive units that had been formed in the colonies, that had been used in the imperial peripheries to conquer non-white peoples abroad, right? Those forms and tactics and tools seemed perfectly appropriate then to import for dealing with the non-white populations at home. And so the logic of the boomerang is that you have these techniques of power and conquest and violent conquest developed overseas, and that they come home when police officials see an equation, really. They construct an implicit and sometimes explicit equation between the sort of dark barbarians in the colonies who demand conquest or who need coercive conquest, an analogy or homology constructed between them on the one hand and on the other hand, non-white populations at home who are increasingly seen as akin to these racialized populations that were colonizing overseas and that were trying to subdue overseas. And they're seen to have the same traits, right? They're seen as inherently violent. They're seen as inherently criminal. And therefore, they require these new techniques, such as these militarized tactical patrol units and other forms.
And you referred earlier to saturation as a strategy to saturate certain areas of the city, and this is what many of the tactical units would do. Can you talk about the degree to which saturation campaigns escalated at this time of a perceived racial threat? And talk about what those kinds of campaigns and other heavy-handed militarized policing practices did to populations in some of these cities that may have inclined them to act in certain ways that, well, I'll let you tell the story, but that might provoke a response from the police.
Right. So this kind of perception among police officials of a crime wave led by non-white populations in America's urbanizing areas. This sort of perception we have to keep in mind was a construct, right? I mean, of course there was crime going on, but there was really an exaggerated fear of non-white populations. So there would be, you know, one incident, criminal incident, or in New York, one of the things that led to the New York Tactical Patrol Force was some fears of Puerto Rican and black gangs taking over the city. And so there'd be these singular or a series of acts committed by non-white peoples. And then the construction was, oh, this whole neighborhood, all of these people are criminal. They're all inherently criminal. And these are all dangerous spaces that require then this technique of saturation, which was a military term. It was the term that they also used overseas. And the idea was to basically take over the neighborhood, send in this force. The force would patrol the neighborhood that was identified as this hotspot of crime and threat to order. And this saturation operation, again, it's exactly like the way in which the U.S. empire would go to, you know, trouble spots around the world. You know, there was a term that the American military is the global policeman that would, you know, saturate areas of, you know, troublesome countries that were resisting U.S. rule, these uncivilized areas. Well, similarly, this idea of saturation was one where the police would go and civilize these uncivilized neighborhoods. And it would involve all kinds of heavy-handed policing in Chicago. The Chicago Tactical Unit, which was called the Task Force, which was formed in the late 1950s, would saturate black neighborhoods in Chicago. And it was discovered that actually in its first year of operation, the task force visited the city's communities 799 times, made 1,122 arrests, issued 48,000 traffic violation tickets, and confiscated 511 concealed weapons, right? And its activities increased in the next 2 years. And as the African American press pointed out, black districts received these visits from the task force disproportionately, right? 20 to 28 times more than the white areas of Chicago. And this, of course, fomented a lot of resentment and a lot of tension between local communities and the police, which in turn, over time, set the conditions for these riots that we then see in the 1960s. Of course, those riots didn't come from, you know, just nowhere, right? There had been a whole history of policing led by this these tactical units and these saturation operations, a whole history there that set the conditions for these riots later. And so, you know, there's this irony, right, that these tactical patrol units and saturating these neighborhoods and stopping and frisking everyone and basically colonizing the areas was meant to stop an outburst of criminality and disorder from non-white populations. But in fact, what it did was ironically create the very conditions for these riots that we see in the 1960s all across the United States. Of course, the riots had a lot of causes, but certainly we all know, and historians have taught us, that one of the main factors in those riots was over-policing, right? Essentially saturation by these tactical units.
And so you write that the tactical units were modeled upon counterinsurgency forces in the colonial and post-colonial world, but their domestic deployment fomented the very sort of insurgency from colonized peoples that those units were initially meant to suppress. Just to elaborate on the irony you were referring to earlier, Julian Goh, professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, joins us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. His new book is Policing Empires, Militarization, Race, and the Imperial Boomerang in Britain and the U.S. Your book also addresses the British imperial and colonial projects. Were counterinsurgency tools and strategies used by British forces in British colonies incorporated into U.S. police practice?
Great question, because this is a major part of the book, too. And there's sort of two ways in which this was happening that I can mention, and there's multiple ones. But I think of two ways in which British colonial policing was incorporated into U.S. policing. One was having to do exactly in this period of the mid-20th century. So these tactical units that I've been talking about, you know, that SWAT represented and that Chicago's task force represented, these came from the American colonial sphere largely, from Philippines, from Haiti, from Nicaragua, and so on. But around the same time that they were developing in the U.S. Empire, the British were developing similar techniques. In British India, for example, in the 1920s, they created similar tactical patrol forces, including, you know, anti-riot units to supplement regular police forces. And the British were also involved in this creation of the Shanghai Reserve Unit that was created in the Shanghai settlements, which was run by international powers, but mainly the U.S. and the British. And the Shanghai Reserve Unit that was part of the Shanghai Municipal Police, which was this early SWAT force, some historians call it one of the first SWAT forces, it was formed by Americans and British alike. And it took in not only the models from the American colonial experience, it also took in the models from the British colonial experience as well, where British colonial policing was really all about these tactical units. So these tactical units, these operations, have to be seen as formed not just in the American Empire, but also in the British Empire. And they were really, I think, a joint Anglo-British or American-British type of coercive tool. The second moment, and this is really critical because it gets back to the larger story that I tell in the book about the deeper hidden history of militarized policing and of policing generally, I would say, in the U.S. and Britain. And it has to do with the founding of what we know as modern police departments. Now, we have to keep in mind that modern police departments as we know it did not really exist in Britain or the United States before the mid-19th century. To deal with crime in Britain and the U.S., you had really just a motley assortment of watchmen and constables. Many of them were volunteers, and then you had these like night watch patrols that walked around and tried to, you know, protect towns or look after towns. They weren't really centralized hierarchical police departments aimed with managing crime and disorder at once. To manage massive outbreaks of disorder, both in Britain and the U.S., the authorities had to call in the army, right? They had to say, you know, to deal with these strikers, for example, let's call in the army, leading to things like the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester in 1819, where the army shot striking workers. Now, the modern police departments, as we know it, changed all that, right? They are centralized state organs meant to dismantle and manage crime and disorder at once. And the first instance was the London Metropolitan Police, the London Met, as we know it today, which was formed in 1829 by a man named Sir Robert Peel. But this London Metropolitan Police, which became so influential when New York formed its police force in the 1840s, it modeled itself after the London Metropolitan Police. All other U.S. departments modeled themselves after the London Metropolitan Police. But when the London Metropolitan Police was first formed, its founders, including Robert Peel, modeled it upon colonial forces. Robert Peel had, in fact, served as the colonial governor, as it were, in Ireland, where they had a whole array of counterinsurgency forces like the Dublin Metropolitan Police, the what would later become the Royal Irish Constabulary, which Peel himself helped form. And of course, these are colonial units meant to deal with crime and disorder, and particularly they were meant to suppress the Irish populations from revolting. So from the very beginning of policing, you have a British-American imperial story here that has shaped policing from the get-go.
Well, Julian, we began this hour with you mentioning current day perceptions of police and the sorts of things they carry and things they do that remind a lot of people of the military. You know, deep concerns about the level of weaponry and the way that the police look at what they see as their adversaries as the equivalent of enemy combatants. What do you think this work of historical sociology, your work, this book, can do to help organizers, activists, and really anyone who's concerned about police institutions in this country? How can it help people think and strategize?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And there's a lot to say, but let me just say a couple things. First of all, we have to keep in mind that this imperial boomerang effect continues into the present. What the book essentially does is look at different moments in which it happens, and one of those moments is the present. You know, ever since we have gone into the Middle East in the wake of the invasion of Iraq, and we've occupied territories in the Middle East, ever since then, we've had a return of various tools and tactics from that theater to policing. So there's a number of examples of this. For example, the LAPD and the New York Police Department and other police departments uses computer software and data platforms originally created for the counterinsurgency efforts and the counterterrorist efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. They use these. They were originally designed by Palantir Technologies. They use these to police now, today, particularly so-called gang problem in the United States, and they've constructed what's known as the gang databases. Police departments have constructed this gang databases, but this is all modeled after some of the software and surveillance techniques that had been developed and were developed by the military for the so-called war on terror, and definitely for the military occupation and control of Afghanistan and Iraq. So this is just one of the many examples, and you have veterans of those Middle East theaters coming back and advising police on how to use some of these counterinsurgency techniques to police so-called gangs. And of course, here, you know, gangs means what? It means non-white populations in impoverished areas. So this imperial boomerang effect continues in all kinds of complex ways today, and I've just mentioned one, but there's many more. The second thing I want to say about the present is what this means, I think, is that we have to be a little bit more global in our understanding of policing in the U.S., right? I mean, policing in the U.S., and I would add in Britain, is a massive issue, but it's even more massive than we'd imagine. It's global. Like, policing as we know it wouldn't exist today, I would argue, without imperialism overseas. And so we have to think about attempts to change policing, if not abolish it, as part and parcel of anti-imperial struggles overseas. And the same people in the U.S., in the streets of Chicago, in Ferguson, in L.A., who are terrorized by police, those people are undergoing experiences that Filipinos share, that colonized subjects overseas share, that people in the Middle East, including Palestinians, share, right? So this is a, you know, a single, I think we need to think about it as a single field of state police power that is racialized and that is colonialist in its very origins and its very structure. And one of the things that justifies the so-called militarization that we see is exactly the construction of citizens as colonial subjects, as inherently violent and savage, right? And one of the scariest things I learned from my research into this hidden history of policing is the way in which the image of colonized peoples, the racialized image of colonized peoples, has also come home along with these techniques. You know, the way in which colonial images of colonized peoples had formed is obviously racist, but it was also deeply a sense of these peoples are intrinsically savage. They're intrinsically criminal. They have no proper understanding of law. And so the only language they understand is violent force. This image justified imperial conquest, it justified colonial conquest, and it summoned the formation and improvisation of these coercive techniques in the first place. And when they come home, they are brought home and imported based upon a similar construction, though this time not of people overseas, but of American citizens, of racialized populations here in the U.S., who are in turn constructed just like colonial subjects are constructed, or seen just like colonial subjects had been seen. That is, as intrinsically barbaric, intrinsically savage, intrinsically criminal, and who only understand the language of force. And this, you know, if you read any many public responses to Black Lives Matter protests or to even acts of criminality, what you see is this language of they're savages, we need to squash them, they only listen to force. This is a colonialist language. It comes from America's imperial experience overseas. And I would argue that just as we were able to overcome this image of colonized peoples to a degree, so too must we rethink both not just the police but the public, rethink our images of who these so-called criminals are on our streets, right? We construct them as subhuman, as inherently savage, but that construction justifies this militarized policing. And I would urge us to take a second and reflect upon the own images we have of our criminals, right? These are human beings, these are fellow citizens. And yes, there's a lot of terrible crimes that happen, but this is not a whole population. This is not a whole set of people who we need to over-police. These are human beings, right? And they're our fellow citizens. And we need to overcome our own biases and prejudices about who these criminals in our streets are.
Julian, we've really only been able to talk about a small portion of your new book, Policing Empires. What else can be found between its covers?
Well, I think what the book allows us to do that we haven't been able to do is scope out a lot more. So in two ways. One is I have a whole story of what happened in Britain, which is important not just because the things that happened in the British Empire impacted U.S. policing, but also because it's its own story. It's its own story of militarized policing, and it shares this ideal of the civil police with America, and it shares this fact that this ideal of the civil police has been fundamentally violated. So we can scope out a little bit that way if you read the book. And also we can scope out historically. This story of the mid-20th century, the imperial boomerang effect, not only continues in the present, but it goes back into the 19th century, and it involves the formation of policing in the first place. It involves various changes and transformations of policing in the U.S. in the early 20th century, and the common strand is A, empire, and the imperial boomerang coming home, and B, racialization. And what differs, if anything, is just the populations that differ, right? So in the 19th century Britain, as you'll read in my book, the real other who was seen as needing militarized policing in Britain was the Irish. And you have actually that in the South, U.S. South, also in the 19th century as well. So we'll get to scope out if you look at my book.
Julian Goh, he is a sociology professor at the University of Chicago, author of books like Patterns of Empire, The British and American Empires, 1688 to the Present, and American Empire and the Politics of Meaning. We've been talking about his new book, Policing Empires, Militarization, Race, and the Imperial Boomerang in Britain and the U.S. Thank you very much, Julian, for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my great pleasure to be here.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.